BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC. Hello, I'm Harriet Gilbert. Welcome to the World Book Club, where this month we've been reading about the life and death of a young prostitute in a harrowing novel, Woman at Point Zero. And here to answer questions about it from an invited audience and from BBC listeners around the world is its author, the Egyptian Nawal El-Sadawi. Nawal El-Sadawi, your writing has caused quite a bit of controversy, I know, in your homeland. And I wonder whether at the moment you're actually living there. Are you able to live in Egypt at the moment?
I can go to Egypt. 3 years ago, I was unable because there was a case against me. I was accused of apostasy, heresy, because of my play, God Resigns, at the summit meeting. But now I won the case, so I can go back.
Well, since the late 1950s, when Nawal El-Sadawi started publishing, she's had a pretty stormy career. She's been an icon of the feminist movement, won awards from around the world, and her work's been translated into 30 languages. She's also, however, had her books banned, had her life threatened, been forced into exile and even for a while imprisoned. Nawal El-Sadawi's work challenges all forms of power abuse, whether religious or secular, but it's centrally concerned with the oppression of women. And Woman at Point Zero, which appeared in Arabic in 1975 and has sold more than 1 million copies around the world, tells a particularly thought-provoking story. It's narrated for the most part by a young woman called Ferdows, who's awaiting execution for the murder of a pimp. Her pimp. Because, as we learn, despite being an exemplary school student, Ferdows has been driven into prostitution. Orphaned as a child, she's taken in by an uncle who eventually forces her into marriage with a grotesque and much older man. And when he violently beats her, she escapes, only to find herself penniless and powerless on the streets. Raped, exploited, even when for a while she gets a badly paying job, Ferdows decides to take control of her life by becoming a prostitute, and is succeeding until the pimp comes muscling in. On the eve of her execution, Ferdows is visited in prison by a woman doctor, and it's she who narrates the opening of the novel. And Nawal El-Sadawi, I wonder if you'd read the scene where Ferdows has finally agreed to meet with the doctor.
I stopped for a moment in front of Ferdows' cell to catch my breath and adjust the collar of my dress. But I was trying to regain my composure, to return to my normal state, to the realization that I was a researcher, a doctor in science, a psychiatrist, or something of the kind. I heard the key grind in the lock, brutal, screeching. The sound restored me to myself. My hand tightened its grasp on the leather bag, and the voice within me said, "Who is this woman called Ferdows? She is only..." But the words within me stopped short. Suddenly we were face to face. I stood rooted to the ground, silent, motionless. I did not hear the beat of my heart, nor the key as it turned in the lock, closing the heavy door behind me. It was as though I died the moment her eyes looked into mine. They were eyes that killed, like a knife, probing, cutting deep down inside. Their look steady, unwavering. Not the slightest movement of a lid. Not the smallest twitch of a muscle in the face. I was brought back suddenly by a voice. The voice was hers, steady, cutting, deep down inside, cold as a knife. Not the slightest wavering in its tone, not the smallest shiver of a note. I heard her say, "Close the window." I moved up to the window blindly and closed it, then cast a bemused look around. There was nothing in the cell, not a bed, nor a chair, or anything on which I could sit down. I heard her say, "Sit down on the ground." My body bent down and sat on the ground. It was January, and the ground was bare, but I felt no cold.
Nawal El Sadawi, thank you very much for that. And now a question about Woman at Point Zero from the audience here at Bush House. The young lady in the back there.
My name is Helen Villalobos, and I just wondered if you could maybe explain what moved you to write about and tell Fadeus' story.
You know, at that time I was dismissed from my job and I had nothing to do. So I started a research about women and neuroses, you know, because I was working as a psychiatrist. And one day I was in the club playing sports. I am a sportswoman. I met a doctor, the doctor of prison in Kanater, in Cairo, near Cairo. And I was telling him I'm doing a research on women and neuroses, why women become neurotic and unhappy in Egypt. He told me, "You should meet this woman." And she's a prisoner in Kanater prison as a prostitute. And she's diagnosed as neurotic person. So put her in your research because she's very interesting. And I advise you. And she arranged for me to have a pass and an admission to the prison to meet Firdaus. Of course, her name was not Firdaus, another name. So he arranged me to go, and I went. I went as a professor, as a doctor of psychiatry, and I met her. So the story started. She told me it's a real story. So when she told me her story, I could not sleep because they executed her. She was executed some days after I met her, and that's why she was indifferent. She told me her story in few hours, and I was sitting on the ground with her in her cell. And when I went back, I couldn't sleep until I wrote the novel.
And did you write her story as she told it to you, or have you made up bits and added bits and reshaped it?
I do not separate between fiction and facts. They are inseparable. Every work, every language, every novel, every book is made because it's not reality. It's like this microphone. It's real. But when I write microphone. So the word microphone is not the microphone. You see? You cannot really write reality. You have to make it. You know, but creativity means that you write reality in a better way than reality.
Nawal El Sadawi, we have a question that follows on from that one. It was emailed to the BBC World Book Club from Rebecca Coleman in Massachusetts in the USA. And she writes this: "Dear Nawal El Sadawi, I first read Woman at Point Zero 10 years ago and it made an impact on me. I have always wondered how much you channeled your own experience and feelings into Firdaus."
Yes, in fact, I was shaken by her story because it's like my story, but in a different way. And I'll tell you something. Most of the women who read Firdaus, whatever age, whatever nationality, they told me, you know, I loved the novel because I felt Firdaus is me, or part of me. And maybe some of you who read the book, somehow you felt that there is many similarities between you and Firdaus, though she was a prostitute and she was killed and everything, and you may be a professor or a doctor or something, but there is something very common with all women universally, with Firdaus. And that's why it was so successful.
That's so interesting because, as you say, the majority of women are not murderers and are arguably not prostitutes. What is it that they see in Firdaus that they think that is my story?
Well, the oppression, the deception. We are deceived by marriage. You know, you remember her comparison between marriage and prostitution. In fact, and marriage is an institution of prostitution. Wives are prostituted in marriage in different way. Of course, wives are paid permanently, you know, when I marry. But the prostitute is paid piecemeal every night, you know. But we are paid for years until we are divorced, you know. So there is a lot of similarity between the institution of marriage and prostitution. And doctors, even in you, if you remember, Firdaus, as a psychiatrist, people come to my clinic to be relieved of their psychological problems. And men go to prostitutes to be relieved of their sexual problems. And I do not separate between sexual and psychological problems and physical problems. So prostitutes are doctors because they are treating men of their sexual frustration, of their violence.
I think some people would say that was a very dark and bleak view of marriage, that you see it as kind of well and regularly paid prostitution.
In fact, I divorced two husbands. I'm ready to divorce the third. But anyway, I think there is a problem with the marriage system all over the world. It's a patriarchal class institution. It's an economic, social, sexual institution. Women are inferior in all the marriage code, all over the world. And I can give you examples from Egypt till the United States, from the Islamic code to the Christian to the Jewish code.
You're talking about religious marriages because it's not necessarily so in civil marriages.
Even civil marriages, yeah, even civil marriages. Because I don't believe that there is really civil marriage or there is really secular society in the world. I teach in the United States and I visit Europe. You know, there is secularism is an illusion.
Well, I can see there's loads of hands going up. We'll come to them.
Is this a microphone I see before me? I was very caught by the narrative voice that you created in the book, the rhythm and the pace and the patterns of repetition that you used. And I was wondering whether you felt anything had been lost in translation into the English of that narrative at all?
Of course, of course. Because the Arabic is a totally different media than the English. And I do not separate between the word and its meaning. It's like between the body and the spirit and the mind. It's like between the shape and the content. They are inseparable.
But tell me one thing, that there's that phrase, sell the buffalo before it dies. Is that an Arabic proverb? Sell the buffalo before it dies?
Ah, yes, yes, yes. The buffalo in the village in Egypt is more precious than the wife. You know, the peasant can own four wives, according to the marriage law. The peasant in Egypt, in my family, I am from the peasant, from the village. So a man, a farmer, a poor man, can marry four wives because it's very cheap to marry a wife. But the buffalo is expensive, so he owns one buffalo and four wives. The buffalo is a very important something in the village. You know, I don't know where I... Did you read it in my novel?
I did, yes.
Where?
It's on page... Oops, it's
okay,
on page.
But anyway, let me come to translation. The page problem 67. Of... Can you translate music? So language is music. Language is sound. You know, I'm talking to you now. You are hearing my voice. This is language. It's music. So you cannot translate music. And that's why there is a problem of translation. You know, you cannot translate, really. You can edit or modify. But really to transfer Arabic to English is very difficult. And that's why I'll tell you a joke. Usually I say that God wrote the Bible in Hebrew and the Quran in Arabic. So what about people who do not know Arabic and Hebrew? They cannot understand the books. The word of God should be in all languages, but God is monolingual only. He knows two languages, Arabic and Hebrew. So this is, even when you read the Quran in English, it is a world of different than the Quran in Arabic or the Bible or anything. There is a big problem of translation.
Hello, my name is Wendy Wallace. I'm a journalist. Every time Firdaus wants to make a fresh start in her life, she hopes that it's her secondary school certificate that's going to bring her opportunities, but of course it never is. Do you think that education is just not enough to offer girls in her situation any hope for a different future?
Very
has
good
anything
question.
Changed in the last 30 years on that?
Very good question. No, education is not enough. You know, I teach creativity and dissidence. And why I teach creativity and dissidence? Because the educational systems in the United States, in England, in Europe, everywhere, kills creativity. Educational systems, like religion, are servant of the political system. It's like a police, policing the mind, controlling the mind. It kills creativity. So I teach creativity and dissidence. Because when the law is unjust, you have to break it. You must be dissident. You know, in order to be dissident, you have to be creative. So there is a relationship between creativity and dissidence. And we need to change the educational system to be creative. Because we receive a very fragmented knowledge from schools and universities. I'll give example from me. I studied in the medical education. Like any education, you specialize. I was a chest surgeon, chest physician. So I know about the lung, but I was ignorant about why people become sick, why the poor people have tuberculosis, you know, and chest diseases. Then I started to link poverty to diseases. That's how I re-educated myself, the connection between economy, poverty, and health, and the relation between economy and poverty with politics and British colonialism or American colonialism or local dictatorship. So that's how a good doctor should understand politics and economics. So I agree with you that we graduate from our universities, very good physicians, very efficient technicians, but ignorant of the world. And that's why we are oppressed.
Another question for Nawal El-Sadawi from the gentleman in the front row.
Yes, it's me. My name is Wadi Ammar. I am an Arab. My question, I wish to ask whether the current position of women in Egypt is the same as it was during you wrote the book.
Of course. It changed. Nothing is the same. Everything is changing, to the worse or to the better. And now in Egypt, we have two trends. Progressive women, writing, fighting, enlightened, fighting against religious fundamentalism, Islamic, Christian, Jewish, connecting this to neocolonial American powers, to the local regimes, to dictatorship, women who are aware, you know, and progressive and fighting. We have this group and this growing. We have also the women who are veiled in mind and in body and they don't know their rights and they are increasing in number because of the effect politically and religiously. So we have the two trends conflicting and that's the struggle in history. But I am optimistic. I have a lot of hope because hope is power. I think that the future will be with the people who are progressive. That's the logic of life. Life progress.
Nawal El-Sadawi, this next question comes from Prague in the Czech Republic. It's from Blanka Hemelikova, and she writes this. Dear Dr. Sadawi, I admire your interest in the destiny of women. I would like to ask you about one detail of your novel. When Ferdows's uncle reads to her when she's a child, what kinds of books had you in mind?
Oh, he was reading the books. He, to her, the books he read himself.
Which the would have been?
He read. It may be a novel, some of the Arabic novels, And her uncle, by the way, was semi-progressive. He was not too bad. He was with her and against her. He was torn between progress and backlash. So he read to her the books. He read to her religious books, history, some novels of the contemporary writers, you know, something like that.
Well, I think it would be nice now to have another reading from Woman at Point Zero. This is towards the end of the novel when Ferdows has just had her heart broken. She gets a job, she falls in love with a man, and she thinks he's fallen in love with her, a man at the workplace. And then she discovers that he's actually got engaged to the daughter of the chairman, even though he's such a left-winger.
The time had come for me to shed the last grain of virtue, the last drop of sanctity in my blood. Now I was aware of the reality, of the truth. Now I knew what I wanted. Now there was no room for illusions. A successful prostitute was better than a misled saint. All women are victims of deception. Men impose deception on women and punish them for being deceived, force them down to the lowest level and punish them for falling so low, bind them in marriage and then chastise them with menial service for life or insults or blows. Now I realized that the least deluded of all women was the prostitute, that marriage with the system built on the most cruel suffering for women. It was midnight and the streets were quiet. A gentle breeze was beckoning softly from the Nile. I walked along, enjoying the peace of the night. I no longer felt any pain. Everything around seemed to fill me with tranquility. The gentle breeze caressing my face, the empty streets and the rows of closed windows and doors, the feeling of being rejected by people and at the same time being able to reject them, the estrangement from everything, even the earth and the sky and the trees. I was like a woman walking through an enchanted world to which she does not belong. She is free to do what she wants and free not to do it. She experiences the rare pleasure of having no ties with anyone, of having broken with everything, of having cut all relations with the world around her, of being completely independent and living her independence completely, of enjoying freedom from any subjection to a man, to marriage, or to love, of being divorced from all limitations, whether rooted in rules and laws, in time or in the universe. If the first man who comes along does not want her, she will have the next or the one after. No need to wait any longer for just one man. No need to be sad when he does not turn up, or to expect anything and suffer when one's hopes are raised to the ground. She no longer hopes for anything or desires anything. She no longer fears anything, for everything which can hurt her, she has already undergone.
Nawal al-Sadawi, thank you very much. And we have a question for you now, which comes from Cairo, from Nayara. And she's got a question that she's on the telephone now to ask you.
Mm-hmm. Hello. Hello, yes. Hello, everybody. Hello, Dr. Nawal. I am Nayara from Cairo, and thank you for taking my question. Ferdows, the heroine of Woman at Point Zero, is condemned to death. And at one point, she says, I'm not looking for anything. I'm not hoping anything. I'm not afraid of anything. And this is because I enjoy my freedom. For me, the second half of this sentence, I'm not afraid of anything, and this is because I enjoy my freedom, is very much you, Dr. Nawal, the Nawal Sadawi that we all know. But having been accused of apostasy and received death threats because of the stand you took and you continue taking regarding gender, sex, politics, and religion, would you today write this sentence in the same way? Would you say that you are afraid of nothing today? And also, would you say that you have stopped searching and hoping? Thank you for answering these questions. Thank you, Dr. Nawal.
No, I am very still hopeful. I'm full of hope, because hope is power. And when I write and say Firdaus lost hope, does not mean that the author lost hope. You know, there is difference. When I write a novel, you know, I am... it's not about my life. It's another thing. So I am full of hope. And we shouldn't lose hope, because hope is power. The other thing is, yes, I lost my fear of death, because my name was on the death list for years. And as a physician, as a doctor, I faced death every day. So death is part of life. We are brought up to fear death as something totally different from life. Though death is part of life. And death is very positive. It's beautiful. Most of the people who died in front of me smiled when they died. They smiled. They were happy. But because you cannot control people and oppress them without fear, so we are afraid of death. This is part of religion, part of politics. So we shouldn't be afraid of death. It's part of life. And all my life, I lived in danger. From childhood, I lived in danger. And now I am 78, and I didn't die, and I will not die.
Ever.
Ever.
Naira, if you're still there, you didn't seriously expect Nawal al-Sadawi to say that she'd suddenly become frightened, did you?
No, I didn't. I admit it, I didn't. But knowing Nawal al-Sadawi and knowing the stand that she takes on very, very crucial issues concerning women, not only in Egypt or the Arab world, but all around the world, I think I should have expected.
Well, thank you very much for your question. And now time for some more questions from the audience here at Bush House. Yes, the lady there.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Nkechi Bike.
Please speak, because my mother tongue is Arabic. clearly, so that I understand.
Okay.
And also, I am in the jet lag, so please, slowly.
My name's Nkechi Ubite, and I'm from London. The UK's Guardian newspaper has called you the leading spokeswoman on the status of women in the Arab world. How important is it for you to continue to highlight the plight of women in your writing?
Oh, it's important. It's very important. I think writing to me is much more important than being a doctor to cure some patients in a clinic or in a hospital. But when I write, I reach millions of people. I reach millions of people. And that's why I consider myself a writer. A writer, a writer, and then after that, a doctor or anything. Writing is it's a very strong weapon. I never used except the pen, but you cannot imagine how the pen is dangerous in my cell in prison. The jailer comes every day and say, if I find paper and pen in your cell, it's much more dangerous than if I find a gun. Writing is very important, and I continue to write.
Another question for Nawal al-Sadawi from the World Book Club audience. Yes, the lady there.
I'm Laura Pepper, and I'm from Hock Wanglala European College. And I wanted to ask about the symbol...
Slowly.
Sorry. The symbol of a door in the novel.
Doors?
Could you elaborate on that?
What doors?
The symbol of the doors and how it represents the possibility of a journey for Firdaus as a character, but how that is then contrasted with the oppression of females within the novel, particularly in the beginning with mentioning about walking into the cell and the closing of the prison door behind the psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. Yet it's also used later in the novel as a symbol representing the possibility of an opportunity that Firdaus can take. For example, the fact that the doors always seem to be closing behind mm-hmm. her.
And now I understood. You know, I am enriched by your symbolism. It never came to my mind, you know. Excellent. And that's the benefit of creativity, that when you read a novel, you discover what the author did not discover, you know. And you discover, in fact, I didn't mean it, but I now understand, so I am enlightened by you.
Thank you.
I used the door as a symbol. Thank you very much.
Another question about Woman at Point Zero to Nawal El-Sadawi. Yes.
My name is Phoebe Pluck-Rose-Oliver, and I go to Hochul Anglo-European College as well. I just wondered...
Slowly.
I just wondered, at the end of the novel, obviously, Firdaus is executed, and it seems that it's at this point that she finally takes control of her life, and it's her final escape. And I just wondered if, personally, you believe that the only way, the only route for Firdaus to have freedom and independence was through death?
That's a good question too. And in fact, many, many critics who didn't understand the novel, traditional critics, said this is a very bad novel because Firdaus accepts death, so this is submission and no hope. It means no hope, no. The defiance, the ability of Firdaus to challenge death is positive because we are all afraid of death. If she was afraid of death, she will sign the petition to the president and come out. But she preferred to challenge death. And I will do that. I will do the same like her, you know? So we need, because she was not afraid of death. She lost her fear of death, and that's positive. So, in fact, this novel is full of hope because it gives this ability of the human power and the woman power to challenge death as a symbol for freedom, as a symbol of struggle also against injustice.
Nawal El-Sadawi, it would be a good time now to have another reading from Woman at Point Zero. This is right near the end, before Firdaus, just before she gets arrested, because it's the scene where she is going to commit the murder. And what has happened is that her pimp has taken over. He's running her life. She says, I'm going to leave you. I was much better without you. And he says, no, you are never going to leave me.
I continued to look straight at him without blinking. I knew I hated him as only a woman can hate a man, as only a slave can hate his master. I saw from the expression in his eyes that he feared me, as only a master can fear his slave, as only a man can fear a woman. But it lasted for only a second. Then the arrogant expression of the master, the aggressive look of the male who fears nothing, returned. I caught hold of the latch of the door to open it, but he lifted his arm up in the air and slapped me. I raised my hand even higher than he had done and brought it down violently on his face. The whites of his eyes went red. His hand started to reach for the knife he carried in his pocket. But my hand was quicker than his. I raised the knife and buried it deep in his neck, pulled it out of his neck, and then thrust it deep into his chest, pulled it out of his chest, and plunged it deep into his belly. I stuck the knife into almost every part of his body. I was astonished to find how easily my hand moved as I thrust the knife into his flesh and pulled it out almost without effort. My surprise was all the greater since I had never done what I was doing before. A question flashed through my mind. Why was it that I had never stabbed a man before? I realized that I had been afraid and that the fear had been within me all the time until the fleeting moment when I read fear in his eyes.
What you listening to the radio can't see is that every time Nawal al-Sadawi reads about Feather stabbing, her hand with a pen in it is going down into the body. So,
but I am against killing, all types of killing. I am against that. I am against despair. I am against irresponsibility. I am against people who have no morals in life. That's it. So this story about to challenge that. This killing is not killing. In fact, she's not killing a man. She's killing injustice. She's killing fear. She's killing double morality. She's killing hypocrisy. Everything we hate.
Well, we have a very pertinent question about the killings, the two killings in the novel. It comes from Jos Plateau State in Nigeria. It's from Amadou Mande Amadou, and he rang the programme earlier to ask you this.
Hello, Nawal. My name is Amadou Mande Amadou. I'm calling from Jos, Nigeria. I'm very lucky to come across a website that sells your book online, and I was able to read it. I want to look at the two murders in the book. One, Fedor's killing of her former pimp because of a degrading treatment, and two, her own execution by Egyptian authority through the death sentence. The question is, can we say both actions are justifiable? If yes, why? And if no, why? Thank you very much.
Well, Amadou says there are two murders in the book. There is Ferdows' murder of her pimp, and then there is the state's murder of her. And do you see both actions as being justifiable, both hers and the state's?
As I said, I am against all type of killings, whether state killing or individual killing. I am against punishment, not only killing. I am against capital killing. I am against not only killing, I am against punishment, even the conception of punishment. And this makes me critical of all religions, because religions is based on false morality. To punish you if you do something wrong and to reward you if you do something good. I am against that. I do the good thing because I love it. I have pleasure in doing good things, not because I will go to paradise. And I do not kill. I do not steal. Not because I am afraid to go to hell. I do it because I hate killing. I hate stealing. That's the real morality, you know. So I am against all state oppression, individual oppression. We need to elevate our morality to a higher human level, above punishment, above rewarding. I am not waiting for the Nobel Prize. My only prize is when a reader send me a letter and say, thank you very much. Your book changed my life. You know, I have pleasure in creativity. You know, I am writing because I love writing. It's pleasure to meet people, readers, and have this exchange.
Well, a slightly different question now about Ferdows's murder of her pimp. This question comes from Daouda El Hadji, who's in Abidjan in Côte d'Ivoire. And writes this: Dear Nawal El-Sadawi, in your novel Woman at Point Zero, you show a woman as a violent creature. But is this truthful and honest? After all, life is given by women.
Life is given by women. Well, so what? Yes. In ancient Egypt, yes, that's the difference between the ancient civilization and the class capitalist patriarchal civilization, that women give life, yes. Fatherhood was not known, you know. It was only the mother who was known. That's why children were named, took the name of the mother in ancient Egypt. So there is a relationship between women and life and creativity and humanity and motherhood, in fact, developed in history much more better than fatherhood. Fatherhood did not, because fatherhood relatively was relatively recent to motherhood. But motherhood is full of humanity. You know, a mother can give her life for her children.
Does that in some way make it all the more shocking or horrible when in a novel like this a woman actually does take the knife from a man and she is the one who kills?
What makes a criminal is the motivation. And even that in all law, in international law, in local law, if your motivation in killing to save life, you are innocent. If your motivation in killing to save your own life, you are innocent. It depends on your motivation, why you kill, you know? So Firdaus, she was defending her life. She's innocent. She's not a killer. Firdaus, who consider Firdaus a killer? She was killed thousands of times by the society, by the system, and the pimp was about to kill her. So she killed him. In fact, she was defending her life. So she was innocent. Violence is a product of injustice. When there is injustice, people become angry and violent. So I hope I answered her question. I don't know.
Yes, the young gentleman there.
Hi there, my name's Alexi Dalton and I'm from the Hockrell Anglo-European College. And I just really wanted to ask, did you intend for the novel to be critical of religion? And if not, do you mind the way that it has been interpreted by the readers?
In fact, when you write a novel, you don't intend anything. You have an urge to write, the pleasure to write. It's something physical and psychological and something you do it, even involuntary, to write. So you don't intend anything. And then the result comes. People will either put you in prison or they will love you or hate you or discuss with you and all that. And that's really the benefit of creativity.
Is it true to say, do you think, that in fact this novel is not particularly critical of religion? What it's critical of is the hypocrisy of people who call themselves religious. There's a recurring image in it of men just having left prayer, walking, rubbing their hands and saying, yes, you know, of course, we must not be violent, we must this, we must that. And in the context of the novel, you know that they will certainly be violent. Is it hypocrisy you're attacking here?
I didn't intend to be critical of anything. I met this woman and I was full of emotions because I saw her and she told me her story. So I went and I wrote. It's a feeling, my anger because of her life. So I wrote it. Of course, it brought all my mind and body and spirit together. Creativity is the ability to write with your body, your spirit and mind, and to bring your agony, your pleasure, your need, everything. So it comes like that. It's spontaneous, very spontaneous.
Am I right in thinking that you're studying the book for the International Baccalaureate? Is that the case?
Yes. At school currently we're studying Woman at Point Zero as part of our international English novel.
It's a good syllabus you've got there. Another question about Woman at Point Zero from Nawal Al-Sadawi from the BBC World Book Club audience.
Michael O'Connor. The question I would like to ask you is about the title of the book, Woman at Point Zero. I mean, it's a very sort of critical point, isn't it? Because you've sort of almost been nowhere, you're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And yet Firdaus had been to hell and back. What I'm confused about is, was this really the sort of the point in a mind where somebody commits suicide, where you've just really had enough and you can't take any more? And was this her get out?
You know, the zero, some people think that the zero is zero. The zero is a revolution. You know how in ancient Egypt, the numbers was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
You're just drawing little marks for
yes.
each one of those.
Yes. And then if you say 10, 11, 20,000, so you have to have a big space in order to put numbers. Then ancient Egyptians invented the zero. So the zero can be 100. If you put three zeros like that, you know, it means millions. So the zero in the arithmetic science is a revolution. You know, it's a revolution. And that's what I meant. A woman at point zero, a woman to be killed, like Firdaus, is like a revolution, like zero. You know, it's a revolution. It can bring billions of ideas. It can challenge anything. So that's what I meant by, though I didn't mean it, but it came like that, because a number zero is very important, and we have to change our conception to the number, because sometimes we say, this person is zero, means he's nothing. We have to change that. No, we have to respect the zero. We have to respect the zero.
Was it the first to be... Was Firdaus the first woman to be executed in Egypt?
No,
we call it a revolution?
No. I mean, execution is everywhere. There were many women who were executed in many countries, you know. But I consider Firdaus a revolution, of course. Her life is a revolution. Her life is... That's why this book was taught in almost all over the world, in universities. It is taught in almost all universities in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, and in some Arab universities. Why? Because it's really something. It shakes the people. You need to shake the people to open their eyes to the jungle we are living in.
Yeah, we do agree, but for the gentleman, a question. It is about the zero.
Yes.
The zero. Which I thought that there are some women before her has been executed for the same reason.
Not
for the same, she was the first one?
No, there are some people who are killed not because they were revolutionary. They were just killing to steal, for instance, if you kill somebody to rob him.
Nawal El-Sadawi, I have a question for you now that comes from a listener to the BBC World Service. She's called Christina Cheng, and she is in Dallas, Texas, in the USA. And she writes this: as a great admirer of your work and your dedication to women's rights, I hope to carry on your message, even in the smallest way, through my own family. I have a 2-year-old son called Ishan. What is the one fundamental lesson that I should instill in Ishan to help protect women's rights and freedoms? What's the one thing poor 2-year-old Ishan has to be taught about how to treat women?
She herself must be a model to him. Not to teach. You cannot teach children if your behavior contradicts what you say. If she tell him, oh, you have to respect women, respect your sister, etc., and she is beaten by his father, or she submits every day to the domination of her husband in front of him, no lesson can do. So she must be a model. The mother should have dignity. She should have... I learned from my mother. My mother taught me something without teaching. You know, one day my father raised his voice. Not insulted her, he respected her, but he raised his voice, shouted at her. She prepared her bag, and she told him, Nobody can shout to me. I can work as a washwoman, as a servant, in the houses, in any house, but I do not accept that you shout to me. And this was a lesson. That's how she was a model to me. That's why I divorced one of my husbands, because he shouted to me. You know, I told him, no, do not shout. My mother said that. You know, so the mother should be a model to her children.
Christina, okay, not easy, but simple. Just be a strong woman and he'll be okay. Nawal El Sadawi, a question from Egypt now, from Marwa Raqqa. Well, in fact, she's sent half a dozen questions, but most of them you've already answered. However, nobody has asked this question yet. Marwa writes, "Hello, Dr. Nawal. Many people have told me that I am a younger version of yourself. Any advice?"
Younger version of myself. Any advice?
People tell her that she's a younger version of you.
Yes.
What advice do you give her?
I give her no advice. I am against advisors. I am against. I shouldn't advise you. But so long she read my books and she is. And I'm also against to be another version. Don't be a version of anybody. You have to be unique in yourself. Creative, unique. Don't imitate anybody. You can benefit from my talk, from my books. We exchange. My book can change her life, etc. But that's full stop. She had to be very independent of my thought, of me. She should not be another Nawal El Sadawi. She should be, what's her name?
Marwa Raqqa.
She should be Marwa Raqqa, not me. She will never accept to be another version of anybody. I'm against worshipping. I'm against heroism. So that's my only advice. Be yourself. Be yourself. Be genuine to yourself and build yourself.
Well, that is all the questions we've got time for. Next month, our special guest will be the Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie talking about Half of a Yellow Sun, her story of three very different people caught up in the Biafran War. Do join us for that. You could also download this programme as a podcast by going to bbcworldservice.com/worldbookclub, or if you're on Facebook, check us out there. For now, though, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and producer Karen Holden, thank you to all you members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here at Bush House. And thanks especially to this month's guest, Nawal El Sadawi.
Thanks.